that's part of the things that I love doing is talking to homeowners about the benefits of high-performance home. And also, when you think about it, if it's required in 2032, it's not too far away. If you build a home today, do you want it to build a home of the past or the home of the future?
Welcome to the Passive House Podcast, brought to you by Passive House Accelerator, a catalyst for zero carbon building. For news, inspiration, and connections from all flavors of Passive House, check out passivehouseaccelerator.com. Sign up to receive regular updates about events, get your questions answered, and contribute to the community dialogue. There's loads of free information for experienced professionals and people just starting out on their Passive House journey. We hope to see you at one of our weekly Passive House Accelerator live webinars. In the meantime, here's this week's Passive House Podcast. Welcome back to the Passive House Podcast. I'm Matthew Cutler-Welsh, coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland in New Zealand. And we've got Zach this week. How are you doing, Zach?
I'm doing great. How are you, Matthew?
Pretty good. It's hot here in in Auckland.
It's not hot here. we're going basically the US is and Canada are, we've got all this really cold Arctic air hanging up, so we're freezing.
Yeah, and Elke joining us from the how are things on the East Coast.
Freezing as well. Especially if you're not sitting in nice and warm passive house.
And you're not?
But an old and drafty house.
Well, we've got Elke with us this week because we're featuring a nice interview with Elizabeth Baldinol, who has been on the, what was she on, Zach? The Alive
That's right.
recently?
That's right. She presented a great presentation called Beyond Efficiency, Unveiling the Embodied Carbon Challenge in Low Carbon Construction. And we'll include a link to the YouTube recording of that presentation in show notes.
Awesome. All right. Well, we're getting into that good discussion on a very topical subject, which just keeps gathering momentum and lots of interest about carbon, both operational carbon, but also how to calculate and account for embodied and upfront carbon in buildings, which is an exciting field. And definitely an emerging field. So before we get into that, we've got some people to thank.
Yes, indeed. So a big thank you to our sponsors that make everything possible here at Passive House Accelerator. So a big thank you to our founding sponsors, 475 High Performance Building Supply, Glavel, Ingwe Architecture, Minotaur, Partel, Rockwell North America, Stocorp, and Zola Windows. Thanks to our champion sponsors, Buizo, Gradient, Icon Windows and Doors, Intelligent Membranes, PH Air Seal, and Source 2050. And a big thank you to our stakeholder partner, NYSERDA, the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority.
Awesome. All right. We've done a little bit of intro there. And we'll put some links in the show notes, as you pointed out, Zach, so people can go back and check out the video if they wish. But I think we should just jump into it and hear this conversation with Elizabeth, who's the founder and principal at CarbonWise.
So welcome, Elizabeth Baudinot, to the Passive House Accelerator podcast. And you're a principal with CarbonWise, which is based in Vancouver. Can you tell us a little bit about how and why you got into low carbon construction consulting?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a bit random, to be honest. I have always been interested in sustainability. I was working for an energy design firm for a couple of years. And then I heard about embodied carbon from at a conference and wanted to really dive into this topic and learn about embodied emissions and operational emissions at the same time and how they are all part of how we build and renovate our buildings. So that's kind of how CarbonWise was born. We've been active for a year and a half now, and it looks like those topics are more front and center, even more now than they were a couple of years ago. And there is a lot of opportunity for us to work and get those numbers and understand where emissions are coming from in the built environment. So we've been very, very passionate about what we do.
Right. Yeah, I think you're totally right. It's coming up more and more, especially the combination between operational and embodied carbon, right? Because it started out with the focus on operational, and now there's luckily or fortunately so much focus on the embodied carbon as well. So have you taken any Passive House trainings as well to be able to look at the operational carbon?
Not Passive House specifically, but I did take a building science course here locally, and learned really on the job as well, working for that other company, surrounded by energy advisors. So we worked on, you know, some of the first net zero or CHB net zero labeled homes in BC, and that really helped me understand where emissions were coming from, and then definitely the embodied carbon piece of it comes in addition to that. About, we have a very stringent energy code in BC called the BC Energy Step Code, where by 2032, all new builds will be either net zero or net zero ready. And as we were working through those projects that were already net zero a couple of years ago, I was looking at it and thinking, well, are we doing the right thing? And then that's how I got involved with embodied emissions.
Can you tell us a little more about exactly what your role at CarbonWise is? And I'm also want to hear about, like, how do potential clients, what's the most common reason that they contact you?
That's a good question. I think some of them understand that there is more to it than just the energy efficiency piece of it. A lot of builders have been actually wondering the same as I was about, what about the materials that we use? Is something that, you know, we import from another country worse or better than having it made locally here? And what are the material choices that we can make? So a lot of people obviously come to us for the energy side of things and the energy modeling and compliance, which is a requirement for any new home in BC. But knowing that we'll also have this background knowledge about embodied carbon, even though the clients don't necessarily want to pay for it because they don't really understand it, the builders appreciate it. I appreciate knowing that, you know, we can have this conversation too.
So I'm always curious about the modeling side of projects. So how do you go about determining how much embodied and operational carbon a project is using, and how much do you use that information to communicate to your clients?
So we use different software. And they are complicated in their own way. I wish there was just an integrated process where we could do everything at once. That'd be the dream, but no, it's not the case. It is very unsexy sometimes, just crunching numbers, Excel spreadsheets. But we've come up with a good system internally, and it makes a lot of sense to do both embodied and operational at the same time, because obviously, what, you know, if you change a material, it's going to impact your energy model, which is a requirement. So we have both kind of in tandem, and there are databases for material emissions. The software we use, obviously, for energy compliance is required, so that we don't have too many options there. And then for the embodied carbon side of things, we use the BEAM tool from Chris Magwood at Builders for Climate Action, and we use Athena as well, depending on the scope and what we want to achieve, depending on the type of building as well.
I'm actually curious about the software that you're using for compliance. That's Hot 2000, is that correct?
Yes.
And that plays a big part in the process of getting the STEP code adopted, right?
Yes, yes. That's the national software energy advisors are required to use for energy compliance STEP code, and also for existing home audits, which we do as well. The reason behind this is that there are some assumptions built into the software so that we are able to compare apples to apples and homes across Canada. It is a pretty old software and not the most intuitive, but we've kind of reached some of the limits of it at some point. There are difficulties for us to model an air-to-water heat pump, for example, and a lot of the assumptions that are baked into the software have changed over time. For example, since COVID, a lot more people work from home. And so the assumptions of load and how they are baked into the software have changed. And this we can manually change them, but then we don't meet the requirement for compliance. So those are things that we've seen in what is in the software and what happens in real life might be different.
For all of our listeners who aren't that familiar with the STEP code, what percentage, I know it's been adopted by various jurisdictions in British Columbia. Can you just give us a sense of how many have are requiring Step 5, which is very close to Passive House, as opposed to the other steps? Because it's not required that no jurisdiction has to meet Step 5 yet unless they have agreed to that. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So over the years, the STEP code started in BC in 2017. And what the province has been saying is we will give local governments the power to implement the STEP code the way they want it with the timelines they want. So some local governments have been very proactive and very innovative. And right now, a few local governments in the Lower Mainland, so close to Vancouver, are adopting Step 5. But definitely not everywhere, not in more remote areas. But as of May 1st, 2023, everybody in BC needs to at least have Step 3 in place. And then they can, local governments can decide to fast track that timeline, knowing that in 2032, all new homes will need to be Step 5.
So Step 5 as a target is on many builders' minds, whether they're in a jurisdiction that requires it right now. Do you think that's true?
Yes and no. depending on, I'd say a lot of people also, even though it's not a new standard and it's not a new code, you'll always have people behind, right? So you always have early adopters, you have then the rest of the people, and you have the ones behind. So we see a wide range of builders with different aspirations for their company and their builds. Because it's also hard for them. And I think this is true as industry. We industry professionals, we understand what it is, we understand why it's there. But then how do we translate that to homeowners into what it actually means for them, right? Like, why would they want to do Step 5 versus what is just the minimum code required right now? So we do help with this because that's part of the things that I love doing is talking to homeowners about the benefits of high-performance home. And also, when you think about it, if it's required in 2032, it's not too far away. If you build a home today, do you want it to build a home of the past or the home of the future? So that's usually how we approach things is, do you want to try to build a home that is going to be required and is going to be required in the future, or just the home of the past that, as soon as even 2 years from now, it won't meet the requirements anymore.
And is it correct that whether you're meeting step 3, 4, or 5, or maybe even 1 or 2, that you have to go through this energy modeling piece and that only a registered energy consultant can do that?
Yes, that's true. Yes. Yeah.
So the firm like yours makes a lot of sense once the STEP codes get really implemented.
Yes, and there have been a lot of energy advisors in the Lower Mainland with the mandate to build more as well right now from the province. It's definitely a good industry to be in. But then there are always, yes, there is minimum code. There is, do you want to go further? What does that mean for, you know, you as a company? And yeah, we love to work on more innovative projects for sure. We love to aim for step five, but it's not always the case.
And what percentage of your projects that you work on are new construction versus retrofits, would you say?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Because there have been a lot of rebates given to homeowners for retrofitting buildings and doing energy upgrades, it used to be more of a 60% existing homes, 40% new homes, but that is quite changing now. We've seen a lot of new homes coming in over the past few months, but also deep retrofits. So existing homes that are going to be performing like new homes, where then our services make a lot of sense. How do we encourage a deep retrofit to go to high performance? There is no requirement for existing homes right now. So if and the homeowners know that, some of them know that they do want a new build performance out of their existing home. If you're taking it down to the studs, you can pretty much do anything you want, right? So we've been doing a lot of those projects, deep energy retrofits, where, you know, they could do pretty much anything. So we are here to guide them and say, well, why don't you do a bit more attic insulation here? Why don't you change those windows here? Why don't you upgrade your mechanical systems? And those would be the results that you can expect in terms of comfort, utility bills, those kind of things.
That's chiefly, I think, a big impediment to doing a deep energy retrofit is understanding what the path toward that is in a practical sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where we've worked on a couple case studies on deep energy retrofits. And when you look at operational emissions and embodied emissions, it also makes a lot of sense. So for us as a company, we love to work on deep energy retrofits because that's where we can play with the numbers. You're improving your operational emissions here. You're making your home more energy efficient. But don't forget that there are emissions associated with your materials as well. So just be conscious about the materials that you're using and make the right choices on that front as well.
So do you have any specific projects that you could tell us about?
Sure. Yeah, we've worked on a case study in North Vancouver, which is published on our website, where we looked at the full life cycle emissions of a deep energy retrofit that wanted to meet the CHBA net zero standard. And that was originally a house using a natural gas furnace, and the homeowners wanted to electrify and obviously improve the envelope. And we looked at a lot of different things. We looked at the importance of the slab and the existing slab, which was actually a big topic for this house, because the homeowners and the builders managed to keep the existing slab, which means that we didn't have to pour any new concrete, which was equivalent to 8 tons of CO2 equivalent. So when you put this in perspective, that's a lot of emissions that have been avoided by keeping the slab. And that's a funny story, because then this home, due to the extension of the renovation, caught the eye of the district. And they said, well, it's pretty much like a reconstruction. So you should be pouring a new slab. And the homeowners went up to them and showed them the reports showing, well, what are you trying to achieve here? Because the slab is in good condition, has been signed off by an engineer. And if we are to pour a new slab, we are going to be emitting 8 tons of CO2 equivalent. And that went up to BC Housing, actually, and eventually the homeowners, you know, made their case and won this case, and they managed to keep the slabs. So for us, that's a really, really good success story on how the numbers are helping in the decision-making process at different levels of either government or you know, the homeowners were definitely on board, but they had to convince everybody else. So That was a big win for this project. And then it is actually being reconstructed right now. I think the roof just went on. So we will be updating the results of this project when the house is complete with more actual numbers.
That's great to hear about. It's a great example of advocating for change within the permitting process, because that'll have impacts for other homeowners who are trying to do something similar. So were you insulating around the perimeter walls? Is that how you managed to avoid insulating under the slab and having to pour a new slab?
Yeah, there was added insulation pretty much anywhere else. And yeah, very high performance. And the builder was really on board with doing high performance anyway, but the homeowners definitely were pushing for it. Just working also in the industry for sure helps in that conversation we are having with them, right? So like, they obviously know the importance of it. They want comfort. They want this house to last for their family as well. So those were definitely very interesting conversation that the builders had with them.
I think this is also a great example for how you can use your modeling tools or modeling results to convey certain goals to people that might not be as into the topic or familiar with everything, right? So numbers are very, very convincing a lot of times.
Yeah, exactly. For us, we absolutely love this project. We love working on projects where it's not just about compliance, right? It's about having this discussion about what does that number mean? And in real life, the builders will be like, well, do I have to do this? Well, no, you don't. Like, this is just the beginning of a conversation. If you don't want to do that, you don't have to do that. We are working on a new reconstruction right now of a home that was lost to fire last year. And the homeowners also want to go as low carbon as possible. So we obviously talked about great insulation, electrification, and then we talked about embodied carbon, which was a bit new to them. But once we explained the concept, they were like, well, yeah, absolutely. It makes a lot of sense. And so now even for everything like countertops and millwork and those kind of things, we are looking at low carbon local options, you know, anything that's made in a sustainable manner, that's either recycled. And we're also keeping the slab on this house, which also saved a lot of emissions. So we are starting this conversation about what do the numbers mean and how they can help in the design phase and in the construction phase too.
So, and you're also helping the local government to understand the embodied emissions. Is that correct?
Yes. So I was working part-time for a nonprofit until October this year. A nonprofit called Community Energy Association, which helps local governments with climate action. And I was obviously working in the built environment department, and we published the first guide related to embodied emissions and strategies for local governments to reduce their embodied carbon. So that was November 2022. And since then, there has been a lot of interest from local governments on what are the things that we can do with the powers that we have to you know, do that next phase of emissions reductions. And then we, with CarbonWise, we worked with a local government on releasing some case studies of step 4 or 5 homes that are electric homes, all electric homes, and then get those first embodied carbon numbers as well, which it's for us, it's adding that new metric to the mix, right? And looking at those numbers over time. So this is the first ones that we've done recently here that will be published shortly. And I'm hoping that a few other local governments that we know are looking at embodied carbon could be doing those case studies moving forward. At this point, it's a lot of education on embodied carbon. So what do the numbers mean? What are the things that you can do right now that are easy strategies that, you know, are actionable right now? And then, you know, how do we incorporate this into the mix of already energy efficiency and the things that we are already doing? So it's a lot of education. It's a lot of crunching those very first numbers to have those benchmarks, because we can't reduce what we can measure, right? So.
Yeah, I think it's so great that you just said that you're introducing a new metric, basically. I think it's just, that's the first step, right? For people just to get used to this, right? What it is and this number. Before they can even really jump in and do their own calculations or make decisions based on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And every time I make a presentation, I have those metrics in the slides, and I say, even though the topic of this presentation might not be embodied carbon, here are the numbers, and you know, we'll plant seeds.
Yeah.
And that's getting to be, I mean, producing those numbers, at least in the city of Vancouver, is becoming more important generally, because there's a requirement, isn't there, for part three building permits in the city of Vancouver, or maybe it's just incentives for reducing the embodied carbon of new construction of single family homes?
Yeah, two things happening right now in the city of Vancouver for part three buildings since October 1st. There is a life cycle assessment required at building permit. There were some requirements for rezoning until now, but now it is required for all building permit applications for any part three building. So that started this fall, and then in 2025 there will be a reduction target. So what's interesting to see is that some of the projects we've been working on at rezoning right now, while we know the building permit will be in 2025, so we already have to bring this up to the design team about, well, have you thought about this? What is your game plan here? Because we are only 2 years away, not even now, we are almost 2024. So a year away of reduction targets. And I feel not everybody's ready for that. And then, so that's the one thing for part three buildings. And then for part nine buildings, there are incentives. There's a program called the Near Zero Program. To submit projects that reduce embodied carbon for part nine, and there are some financial incentives to, depending on the amount of reduction you get, then there is a financial incentive for that. So we're working on a fourplex, or we'll be working on a fourplex soon, and I know that the city has had maybe 10 applications so far. It hasn't been as popular as they thought. I think it's just the fear of, you know, that's new. How do we get in? What does that mean? Who can help us? So, but it is a great way for also the city to collect the data, right? So with that embodied carbon metric, then all the metrics we're going to be adding to the mix, then, you know, they will be able to draw those conclusions and analyze those numbers.
And what are part three and part nine buildings again?
So part nine buildings are anything residential less than three stories, and part three is everything else.
And then in general, on your website, I saw that you have a whole big section about grants and rebates. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, there are a lot of rebates available. Most of them are for homeowners renovating their homes. And that's where the federal and provincial governments have been pushing for energy efficiency upgrades made to existing homes, because we know that existing homes are, you know, they represent a lot of the homes that we have in Canada, and they will be standing for, you know, years to come, versus it feels like we've figured it out for new homes, you know, like we can start from scratch. We know what to build. We know the efficiency that we need to build at. But what do we do with the rest of the homes that are already there? So it's not as easy, I would say, for existing homes, because there are a lot of different factors, the age of the home, the condition of the home. But there are rebates that are available for homeowners to make energy upgrades and live in more comfortable homes, even if they, you know, they have been standing for years. So there are great programs out there, and the federal government just announced that they will be closing their program in March, which is a bit sad to hear, but I'm sure there will be a new program coming. I heard that the energy upgrades were not providing enough energy and greenhouse gas savings as they intended to. A lot of people were switching to heat pumps, but with doing no other energy upgrades. So then you are definitely electrifying. You're reducing your greenhouse gas emissions, but you're not reducing your energy demand so much. So I expect there will be a new program coming soon.
Yeah, that's long been a problem that people get a new heating system that's maybe works a little bit better. And then they've been uncomfortable for years. And so maybe they set their temperature a little bit higher because finally they actually can get the temperature that they want. And if they don't do any modifications to their home at all, then that's probably a lot of energy leaking out all over their house. So it's a problem. Yeah,
and a big thing we see as well, and it's, I've been talking about this forever, but airtightness is a huge component in passive house as well, right? Like we need to reach 0.6, and that's for a reason. And so on existing homes, we see homes that have, an air change per hour of like 14 sometimes. So that means there is just so much air escaping your house on an hourly basis. So if you switch from a natural gas furnace to a heat pump, well, your utility bills are going to go up the roof because now all of a sudden for one unit of natural gas and one unit of electricity in BC, electricity is more expensive. And so it has driven bad reputation to heat pumps about, well, it's going to cost me more. Well, for sure, it's going to cost you more if you don't do anything else. But if you start doing air sealing work and insulation work and you actually reduce your demand, then that's when it starts to make sense. And also a lot of contractors will be oversizing mechanical systems as well, because, in the past, you would need to size for those leaky homes. And then all of a sudden, those homes retain heat much better. So then you can reduce the size of your mechanical systems, which is another saving. But it's still a work in progress here. A lot of, homeowners wouldn't understand this, right, necessarily. So do they get the best advice in when they want to switch their natural gas furnace to a heat pump? Yes, no, maybe. So those are the things that I always say, airtightness is number one, because it is also such a cheap upgrade. You can do it yourself as a homeowner. We've actually run a couple of workshops in Nanaimo to teach homeowners how to do it themselves. So a lot of things, that are not necessarily expensive to do that will bring much more comfort and cost savings.
So what is your number one air sealing strategy that you teach to homeowners?
Well, at the workshop, we were looking at windows and doors specifically and just penetrations and just, caulking. It's not that hard, and just weather stripping. And you see it at every single home we go. The doors, the windows are the leakiest. This is often how it is.
So looking into 2024, what is the most exciting thing that you're looking forward to that's coming up for you or for regulations?
Well, we are working on that new project I was mentioning, that the house that was lost to fire last year. It is going to be probably the project of the year for us, thanks to a lot of communication about it from the whole team. So the homeowners, the builder, the designer, and the architect are very, very passionate about this project, because it all brings everything back that we've been talking about. And and we're going to be, so the house will be rebuilt in 2024. And we are going to be presenting it at Buildex, at the home show as well in February. And we'll be advertising this house as a way to rebuild better. So obviously tragic story, having lost your house to fire, but the homeowners are in very good spirits about, well, we want to make this house a better house for us, our family, and for our generations to come. We want to have the family living in the house. So there is a really good, it's not just a good story, but it's what we would like people to look for. So it, not just building a house to build a house and flip it, but build a house to have your family living in it and have a comfortable, low carbon house that is good for the environment and good for yourself. So that's a project that I'm really looking forward to in 2024 for sure.
And you mentioned Lost Fire. Was that a structure fire or was it a wildland fire?
No, it was a structural fire inside the house.
Uh-huh. I know, as everybody does, that in BC it rains a lot. So in the areas that where most of your projects are located, is building for fire resilience a concern? For not for structure fires, but for wildland fires, or not so much where you're operating in?
Yes, it has become a concern, obviously not in the big city centers, but everywhere else. So everywhere else in BC, we've seen the impacts of fires over the last few years. It has been devastating for so many families. And there is a fire code, which, you know, we've seen homes built to the to the standard that have burned last summer. So is it enough? I don't know. This is not my area of expertise, but definitely it has been more of a concern and front of mind for people who are building new homes.
It's interesting to try and balance the fire resilience with embodied carbon issues, because obviously the exterior siding, you don't, I mean, at least here in California, you don't want to go with wood anymore. That's just not a positive choice to be making. I wonder how that's affecting your advice that you're giving to clients.
Definitely in the way that we think about resiliency in the way in our work always. And we've also heard from people who lost their house last summer that, you know, the point of entry was the window. And so when the homes that are built in more remote areas have a window to wall ratio of 80%, then we know that's not resilient. So the choice of materials for sure are pretty much now ruled by the code, right? So the fire code, but the design of the house and how you know, how well it would withstand fire and even smoke are things that are, we think about, we don't specialize in, but we definitely think about them.
So another topic that seems to be gaining more and more traction, particularly in regards to embodied carbon, is circularity. Like when you're looking at building a home now, you might want to think about how everything that it is built with can be reused in the future at the end of the life cycle. Is that something that you are considering as well?
Yes, those are the things that we think about as well. When we do life cycle assessments, there are assumptions that go into what happens at the end of life. And those assumptions are what 60, 100 years down the road. So it's very hard to predict what is gonna happen. But we definitely, on the other way around, what is happening to existing homes now is also important. So when a house is being demolished, well, can we actually deconstruct this house? Can we reuse some of those materials? Can we even just relocate that house somewhere else in this condition, you know, instead of just demolishing it and building brand new? And this is what definitely we need to think about, reusing as much as we can, either in the condition it is now, or remanufacture and recycle. But this is definitely more local, less emissions intensive than starting from scratch. So that's definitely something that is very, very gaining momentum here in the Lower Mainland, about relocating homes, deconstructing homes, reusing those materials. And a lot of education again, but a lot of local governments are looking at, you know, deconstruction policies and making sure that those homes don't end up in the landfill. And then there will be the other topic is designing for disassembly as well. So how do we design now so that those homes can be taken apart in the future? which there is a new course at BCIT now available for that. So it's slowly coming. But yes, as a philosophy, I always say less is more. So, you know, the more we can reuse, the more we can do locally as well is always so important.
Yeah, no, that's great to hear, especially that it's getting supported by the government as well. So that's great.
Yes, yeah. Some of the new policies coming up are very, very progressive in this way.
And I just want to back up for a second to your own education. You mentioned BCIT and a training course there. Your own education, can you just tell us either about yourself or for someone who's looking to get into the field that you're in, what kind of educational pathway would you recommend, or what did you follow?
I don't know if I'm a great example, because I studied business actually in France. And then, so that's, I was always interested in sustainability, but as a kid, I thought you needed to be a biologist to be helping the planet, you know, and then eventually went to business school, and then got into this field kind of randomly, but loved it right away. The science, the building science, the impact that construction has on the environment, and so the impact that then my work working in this field can have, is what motivated me. And I took a lot of independent courses, BCIT courses on whole building life cycle assessment, building science courses from CHBA. So I kind of self-taught myself a lot of the things that I know now. And there are no really, there is not really a one path. I think we can all do our bits with what we have and what we know. And this is what we are seeing, especially for the embodied carbon side of things, because on the energy side of things, you need to be a registered energy advisor. And there is, you know, training for that. And that's kind of required. But on the embodied carbon side of things, well, you could be an architect trying to design and build low carbon buildings. You could be a structural engineer. You could be an energy modeler. So it can be, and we see this as being more of an add-on to existing consultants who are passionate and interested in this topic, because it is affecting everybody in the design team. So anybody could be doing this work. And that's something that I volunteer with the Carbon Leadership Forum, which is the hub for embodied carbon here. And there is a lot of us from very different backgrounds, actually.
Yeah, and you mentioned before that once you're doing one kind of modeling, it's really easy to add on the other part, and that most of the time, or always, it goes hand in hand. So it just makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, it makes a lot of sense to do the energy modeling and the embodied carbon modeling at the same time.
Great. Well, on that note, thank you so much for your time, Elizabeth. I really appreciate you talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, and thank you for enthusiasm. It's nice to look at, I don't know, I feel like the way you look at things are more, everything is an opportunity, right? And not just a problem that we need to solve. So I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Yes, definitely. There are a lot of opportunities for our industry to be doing better. And I think we can all do our part.
And that was Elizabeth Baldenau, who's the founder and principal of CarbonWise. Thank you for that, Ilka. And of course, Mary, who unfortunately not with us today. But we'll start with you, Ilka. What were your highlights from your conversation?
Well, for me, one of my favorite topics is always modeling, energy modeling or carbon counting. Yep. And we talked about that quite a bit. And I'm always really interested in hearing about what the modeling tool can do besides just making a decision making on a project, and how practitioners use that tool. And I thought it was very clear that, of course, they use it to really investigate their projects and for decision making, but also to talk to their clients and even going to get decisions all the way up to BC Housing made, or different decisions based on reports out of their modeling tools. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, there was a strong theme about doing everything at the same time in an integrated way, which obviously makes sense. And Elizabeth pointed out you change one thing to improve the operational efficiency and thereby reduce the operational carbon, and then that is going to have an immediate impact on your embodied carbon if you're changing materials and products that you're installing, or whether you're changing from concrete to timber or steel to concrete, steel to timber. So it does make sense to do that at the same time, and I guess that's one of the advantages of having an organization, company like CarbonWise that can do all that at the same time. Zach, how about you?
Well, I really enjoyed the discussion of the North Vancouver case study and the power of data. It's just that, you know, that she equipped the homeowners with the carbon data around pouring a new slab. The engineers had, you know, figured out that the existing slab would work for this major renovation. So they were able to push back on the jurisdiction, you know, that was the, kind of insisting on it on pouring a new slab and show, you know, hey, what is our goal here? The emissions impact of pouring a new slab is so massive. That was cool to hear, to see, and I think a kind of illustration of how important this engagement with embodied carbon accounting is in this project.
Having the numbers to back that.
Exactly.
I mean, I hadn't even thought about that. And in some ways, it's kind of scary that the assumption would be that if you're going to build, or you just have to pour a new slab,
right?
Even if there's nothing wrong with the existing one, and I assume that there has to be some checking that it's, you know, still structurally sound, and as I think Mary pointed out, that you might want to insulate the edges of the slab and upgrade what's there, but you don't necessarily have to dig it all up, throw it out, and pour a completely new one if you're going to build something of a similar shape and size.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think that also points to one of the great things in these early days of embodied carbon accounting and kind of grappling with this issue of embodied carbon is that there are this low hanging fruit. There's these simple things that if we just know to look for them, we can address. And of course, that doesn't get all the way to getting to zero carbon building yet. But we can do a lot better in the industry with some fairly simple moves and get, you know, make some big strides at the beginning of this kind of race. And I think this is one of those examples.
Yeah. And certainly the analyses that I've seen, and we're starting to do this now for new homes in this part of the world, is that the concrete and steel are the biggest pieces of the pie. When you have a look at a pie chart of what makes up the biggest components of embodied carbon, it's usually the concrete, which is usually the floor in a house, might be the walls in a if you're doing a tilt slab or a precast kind of construction, and then the steel, whether that's structural or roofing or cladding, they're the biggest pieces. So if you can reduce those or remove those from your new project, that goes a huge way to reducing the overall impact that you're going to be accounting for. I guess one of the themes that keeps coming up with these conversations about carbon is the fact that it is still emerging at this stage, and that has implications for education and training and how people get into this field. And I think that was really useful comments from Elizabeth at the end about how she got into it, not necessarily from a building science to begin with, but has learned that along the way and implemented it with her business training. And I think the field's open at the moment for lots of people to come in from different parts of the industry. And I think that it will emerge. There are courses out there now where you can go and do, and I know people that are going and upskilling during their careers to learn how to do carbon accounting, learn what the standards are internationally, and learn what the tools are and how to use them. So it's a pretty exciting field, and I definitely encourage people to get into it, because I think as Elizabeth has done here to grow in a business focusing on that, I think there's a lot of emerging opportunity for people if they want to learn more and become a consultant and a leader in this field. I guess one other thing that pops out for me is the value of introducing metrics to people. And the end goal is to have thresholds and benchmarks and standards that we want to, that we need to stay below for both operational and embodied carbon. And it's great having things like the STEP code in British Columbia that allow the industry to know where it's going, because those numbers are there for future dates like 2025 and other points in time in the future, so the industry knows where it's going. But that's still not necessarily on the radar for a lot of people in the industry. So drip feeding or planting the seed, as Elizabeth puts it, of just showing people some numbers and getting them used to what those metrics are and some of the values that we use, things like carbon equivalents and those terms, I think is really important that we start introducing those to the general industry so people kind of get used to that language.
Well, and it can have impacts in far off jurisdictions too. I mean, I first heard the term TEDI, or thermal energy demand intensity, in a report that was generated by the city of Vancouver, like in 2015, as they were implementing their first incentives around passive house. And thermal energy demand intensity, refers to essentially one of the pillars of passive house. And now we see both passive house and thermal energy demand intensity as central pieces of Massachusetts and this stretch code policies there, and they're cribbing directly from City of Vancouver, and that's so I think that you're totally right. Like these metrics and units of measurement, I think represent kind of the way that we're beginning to get a more and more sophisticated understanding of energy and carbon, and now extending into embodied carbon, and Chris Magwood also has a really interesting presentation or set of ideas around, like, do you measure is square footage by square foot the right measurement? Is it better to be looking at these different measurements have different results. If you include, like, you're counting the square footage of a garage, or you're just counting the square footage of the living space, and all sorts of interesting questions to address in what is the right metric to really move the needle on embodied carbon.
Well, I think it's also maybe not even about what is the right metric. It's about everyone does the same thing so that it's actually comparable. Right. So, and I think that's a little bit what the STEP code is also trying to do with this energy modeling software that they have, the HOT 2000, where it's one tool that everyone basically has to use in order to even get a building permit. Right. On the one hand, I think it's great because it gets really everyone used to, again, this metric or to this viewpoint of energy modeling, but also it's not only a tool, it's also a means of comparison where every project is basically looked at from the same, in the same perspective.
Very good. We'll put that link up, put the links up, Zach, to the recording so people can go and check out Elizabeth's video presentation. Awesome. Yeah, and as I said before, I just encourage people to if they don't know about carbon, definitely start finding out about it. It's such an emerging opportunity for people to add to their services if they're in the field of energy modeling, as you said, Ilka, or just doing passive house stuff. It's really a great feather to add to your cap in terms of services.
I would one thing I would add is just I think in line with Ilka, what you're talking about of like having a standardized approach is the work of ECHO. which is this collaborative effort with a bunch of, it's a coalition with Architecture 2030, Building Transparency, the Carbon Leadership Forum, International Living Future Institute, USGBC, and there were and a bunch of others. And it stands for Embodied Carbon Harmonization and Optimization Project. And its purpose is to ensure that all embodied carbon reporting at both the whole building level and the whole project scale is following the same approach, like definitions and scopes and approaches. So I think that there is some really important work that's happening in that area. And not to preempt my little plug for Reimagine Buildings 24, but Stacey Smedley of Building Transparency has been really central in that work, and she's going to be presenting about that at Reimagine Buildings 24. Chris Magwood will be presenting about his Zero House project, which is it's all about circularity. It's a house that's been deconstructed and constructed three times so far. And we're also, Felix Heisel will be presenting about construction and circularity. So these are really important conversations that we're excited to be able to share on the Reimagine Buildings program.
Nice. Awesome. All right. Well, thank you to Mary in her absence, and also to you, Ilka. Fantastic interview there. Really great business to learn about. Zach, what have we got coming up?
Well, we have, let's see, we have a very special episode of Pacifist Accelerator Live with Lisa Richmond. This is for the last Wednesday of January 2024. She was at COP28 just a couple of months ago, and as part of a delegation with Architecture 2030, she's a senior fellow there, and she's going to be sharing her perspectives and kind of takeaways from COP28. So please join us at Pacifist Accelerator Live. And then, of course, the big event for us at the Accelerator is Reimagine Buildings 24, which is on March 7th and 8th, excuse me. This is the 24-hour around-the-world online global conference. A big shout-out to NYSERDA for being our stakeholder partner on this. We also have a bunch of signature sponsors and community partners. But this is like, we have over 80 presenters involved in this conference around the world. It's like condensing, like an entire year of programming for us and putting it into this 24 hours. So it's been all hands on deck here at the Accelerator. We're super excited, and we hope that people will join us, and we'll include a link in show notes to the registration page.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone. Thanks, Ilka. And Zach will be back again next week on the Passive House podcast.